Okay. Hello, greetings to everyone. Hello. I'm Rob Olson. I want to welcome everyone to Dallas Monsters Forum. Appreciate everyone coming out. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of every month from September through May. We'll be taking our normal summer hiatus coming up, but we still have several great lectures before that time. If you haven't paid already, you could do so immediately after the lecture of Jack Youngkin, our esteemed treasurer. He can collect those monies. It's $5 for if you're a student. Any students here tonight? Students? Sometimes we'll have a few students. Students are $2. And if you want to become a subscriber, then the cost is $35 for 6 months. It's I forget exactly how the math works.
It's like 12,
but you know,
12 lectures.
That's some controversy. I've got a medical doctor that's cooking my mathematics. So. I was never good at mathematics or arithmetic, so don't hold me to that. But anyway, it's $35, and it is a bargain. If Jack Youngkin, our treasurer, assures me that it is a bargain. So anyway, and then make sure, please remember to pay your meals after you leave. Bring a check by, and if you can be generous with your wait staff, that would be much appreciated. We have a website. We have a lot of the information about our group. It's www.philosophersforum.org, and you can sign up for our email list. And if you want to get access to us through Meetup, you can do it. You can just type in Meetup, Dallas Philosophers Forum members, and then that'll give you the access to that. So I think several of you all have found out about us through Meetup, and that's been a great way to get the information out. And then last thing I'd like you to ask to please turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate at this time. And now I'd like to introduce our speaker. I had the pleasure of speaking to Dr. Levine at dinner tonight. And this guy knows a lot about the human brain. He's, what do they call it, a brainiac? Is that the right term, David? Is that the scientific term, a brainiac? But it reminds me, my dad, rest his soul, he used to have this phrase, and I'm gonna quote this, provide you this quote, and I want to see who knows who wrote this. Perhaps our speaker does. Quote, "I'm the brain, dear Watson. The rest of me is a mere appendix."
Sherlock Holmes,
yes. Arthur Conan Doyle. "I'm a brain, dear Watson. The rest of me is a mere appendix." He was a Scottish physician, and writer. We are pleased to have Dr. Dan Levine with us this evening. Dr. Levine is a professor of psychology at the University of Texas at Arlington, UTA, right down the street. We very much appreciate him driving all the way out here from Arlington tonight. His research centers on computational models of the brain's involvement in decision-making, and he supervises an experimental laboratory on emotionally influenced decision-making. He has given presentations for many interdisciplinary audiences, some of which can be found at the website right there, UTA.edu, Psychology Faculty Levine. He was a longtime member of the Board of Governors of the International Neuro Network Society and served as president of this society in 1998. He is currently general co-chair of the International Joint Conference on Neuro Networks to be held at the Fairmont Hotel, Dallas, in August of 2013. Is that open to the general public?
It is open to the general public, but the registration fee is pretty steep.
Is it really? Okay. Is it more than $5?
$550 for members early.
How much?
$550.
Okay, that's a little bit more than what we charge.
Yeah. There's a bunch of engineers and corporate people involved in that.
Okay, great. His topic this evening is emotion and reason. Partners, not opposites. So please join me now in welcoming Dr. Daniel Levine.
Okay, thank you very much, Rob, and members of the society for bringing me all the way out here from the next county. My roots really go back, I started out in math, and I came from a family where science was very much emphasized, but I was a student in the 60s, and I wanted to make it relevant. So I worked for 2 years in the National Institutes of Health as a means of going somewhere other than Vietnam. And while doing that, I got to know a bunch of neuroscientists, one of whom, Paul McLean, I'm going to be mentioning it here, and really got very curious and tried to figure out a way to connect that with math. So I got a PhD in applied math, but it was neural network related, with a guy named Steven Grossberg, who I think I mentioned here somewhere too. And then gradually, I got at a postdoc at a medical school at UCLA and various math appointments with an academic gypsy until the interdisciplinary fields were well recognized, until the people in psychology and neuroscience had enough data and enough computers to appreciate modeling. And so I gradually was doing less theorem proving, more modeling, as well as expository work. And so at the time of promotion to full professor, moved from math department to a psychology department. All right, now, there's a lot of baggage in our culture about emotion and reason being opposites. And officially speaking, reason is considered superior. But there's a backlash and sort of romantic underground which makes emotion superior. I'm going to throw away both and say they both play a role. Emotion and cognition are extremely tightly interconnected in the brain. And talking about one being superior to the other is not only silly from a scientific viewpoint, it is, as I will show, has caused a lot of harm to society. And so it's time to time to get beyond that and talk more intelligently as well as emotionally about it, about these things. So here are some of the phrases. Act rationally, not emotionally. Opposite to that. And you hear this from therapists and counselors. Get out of your head and into your feelings. Now, the phrase, if you look at the phrase, acting emotionally, we use it for somebody who, you know, gets real mad at his wife's lover and goes and kills her. Goes and kills her, maybe kills his wife also. Or getting attracted to somebody who's an obviously unsuitable partner. That's what we use acting emotionally for. But we don't use it for somebody who supports his or her family out of the emotion of love, or somebody who works steadily on a job out of passion for his or her work. And these people are just as much acting on emotion as these people are. But the popular usage denigrates it. Now, what are the roots of this cultural split? I could probably do a whole nother lecture on that, but I'll just do a very quick summary of a few people, few philosophers who said something about it. There was the tripartite soul of Plato, the appetitive, competitive, and calculating. Appetitive being more emotional, calculating being more rational. Aristotle changed the terminology to nutritive, sensitive, and rational. And Aristotle started with the idea that the good life involves control of the will and the rational side of ourselves over the emotional side of ourselves, you know, controlling our passions and our appetites. But Aristotle still felt that emotions were essential, and this is from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Aristotle's ethical works treat the pathe, that's related to pathos, sympathy, empathy, and other words like that, both as susceptible to reason and integral to the good life, even as they allow that emotions can impair our reason. So Aristotle, I think, had a pretty balanced outlook. But he was not as dualistic as Descartes was many centuries later. Descartes said that the will or soul is separate from emotions or bodily appetites. That was his dualistic outlook. Now, there's a lot of debate as to whether how much Descartes really believed it and how much this was some deal he made with the Catholic Church that they would avoid hassling him. But he thought that the will can and should govern desires, and will is the ultimate motivational force. I didn't mention other philosophers about the same time, notably Spinoza, who I found very dense reading, but he seemed to pretty much support the idea of emotion and reason as partners, and so did Kant about 100 years later, from what I gather. I've not read Kant. Now, Antonio Damasio is one of the several neuroscientists I'm going to mention. He's probably the one whose name is most familiar to you. But there's four others I mentioned who I think are equally important. Blamed Descartes for the denigration of emotion as against reason. And maybe he's right, but it also had to do with more broad social factors like the rise of science and technology, the Enlightenment, and the belief that we could order the environment to maximize human welfare, conquer the environment, you might even say. But over the centuries, there's been a backlash, the 19th century Romanticism and art and music, the hippies and environmentalists in my period, who I took some cues from, but didn't go all the way, etc. Now, what do neuroscientists say about emotion and reason? Paul MacLean, writing in the 1960s, I was sort of informally attached to his lab, so I consider him, not in an official sense, but in an unofficial sense, one of my mentors. And then he wrote a book in 1990. He passed away about 6 years ago. Paul MacLean developed what's called the triune brain theory, that there were three layers of the brain from different stages of evolution. There was the reptilian brain, as was called, which controlled instinctive, automatic behaviors. There was the paleo-mammalian, old mammalian brain, involved in emotional behaviors and feeling states. And finally, the neo-mammalian brain, which processes sensory information and involved in thought and conscious planning. And the idea was that as we evolve from reptiles to other mammals to humans, we don't discard the previous brains, we just build on them. And so these different parts of the brain have to live together and interconnect, and sometimes run into problems that way. And here's the layers here, the reptilian, paleo-mammalian, and neo-mammalian, which really balloons out. It's really the brain in birds and reptiles more like a tube, and then start building the cover around it. It's only in primates that you really get the round brain that we're used to. All right, now, so you've got this, as MacLean said, man and horse and crocodile having trouble communicating with each other. But Wally Nauta was another one of my mentors. He taught a graduate neuroanatomy class that I took at MIT. He said that he talked about the frontal lobes as the prime communicator between these different areas. That got me really interested in the frontal lobe, and I've done several neural network models relating to frontal lobe function. And this, he says that there's something called interoceptive censorship. Interoceptive means feeling on the part of the viscera, the other organs of the body. That we go through a plan, and if it doesn't feel right, if it literally makes us sick, we censor it. So he kind of anticipated Damasio's idea of somatic markers, which some of you may be familiar with. And Damasio located this connection to a particular part of the frontal lobe, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And he found that patients with damage to that area, they talk about things in such a dispassionate manner, you know, kind of like Mr. Spock from Star Trek. But they're lousy decision makers. They just obsess endlessly over minor things like what restaurant to go to. Now here are some people, there are many, many people who've been important recently in emotional cognitive interaction. Here are three that I mention as particularly important. Joseph Ledoux, who mapped out the involvement of the amygdala, which is part of the paleomammalian brain, in automatic fear reactions. And people who read Ledoux kind of had the feeling of the primacy of the amygdala and emotion, which is not quite right. Luis Pessoa, who I think is the best in terms of a system viewpoint. And interestingly enough, he's an experimental neuroscientist, but he did a postdoc with the same person who was my advisor, at least with his group, on the neural network model. And this led him to have a good system viewpoint. Emotionally significant events have an advantage in processing but are still subject to attentional control. And I'm going to detail what he said about that in a moment. And Jaak Tanksepp, that's an Estonian name, although he's in the United States right now, I think Washington State. And he wrote a 2012 book on the neurochemistry of what he sees as seven basic drives: seeking, caring, fear, anger, lust, play and joy, and sadness. I mean, all kinds of different people have different parcellations of the basic drives and emotions. So I don't think one is necessarily any better than others. All right, well, here I mentioned the amygdala. Here's where it is. It's down. This is a cross-section of the brain, frontal lobes being here. Basal ganglia, which is sort of the final common pathway for deciding to make or not make movement. The amygdala, which is so called from the Greek word for almond because of its shape, is down here toward the front, just below the temporal lobes. Okay, here's what Pessoa said. First measure activation in regions responded differentially to faces with emotional expressions compared with neutral faces. We then measured modulation of these responses by attention using a competing task for the high attentional load. So they had them look at emotional faces, but also they had some, they were multitasking, they had some other things dividing their attention. Contrary to the prevailing view that the emotional faces would just sweep their attention, all brain regions responding differentially to emotional faces, including the amygdala, did so only when sufficient attentional resources were available to process the faces. And that's to say, okay, the emotions have an advantage in attention, but they can be overridden by sufficiently complex tasks. And here is Pessoa in a later article expressing a kind of viewpoint that you shouldn't specify areas in the brain as being emotional or cognitive, affective or cognitive, but they're really connections of different brain areas and it gets really mixed together a lot. All right, and here is the systems view. Starting with Grossberg, I was Grossberg's PhD student in the early 1970s, and I continue to work in the same general kind of modeling that he does, that emotions and drives are needed to differentiate cognitive units. That is, to keep different cognitive representations of different events from just getting mixed up with each other in short-term memory. Emotions kind of help to differentiate. And he developed a mathematical and systematic theory to illustrate this. And here are two other former UTA college, psychology colleagues who are now at Cornell, husband and wife, Valerie Reyna and Chuck Brainerd, who said that when we process things, we put them in memory, we learn the, we process the verbatim, the exact details, but we also process and emphasize the gist or the meaning of it. And what we take to be the gist, what we select, can vary tremendously. But as we go from childhood to adulthood, we rely less on verbatim and more on gist. And the gists are not necessarily emotional or affective. They can be, but they're not always. Now, this is what the dynamic perspective tells. People think of cognition and emotion as opposites. They're not. And people think of emotion and decision. I mean, even DiMaggio says emotions are closely tied to the body. And he's right, up to a point. But it's not necessarily the case that we do necessarily what we like to do or what gives us the most pleasure or avoids the most pain. So they're not tightly coupled. Emotion is one thing that influences decision making, but not the only thing. All right, now it is true that short-term emotional reactions can interfere with reason if we get really afraid of something or really ecstatic about something. Can interfere. But long-term emotional satisfaction is a partner to reason. And you know what Rob suggested about rational maximization of happiness bears that out. So there's a difference between the effects of emotions in the short term and the effects of emotion in the long term. Now, I've always felt that from my math background, reason produces theorems. It tells you how to get from step A to step B. But reason does not tell you what step A to start with. Emotion can do that. So axioms have to come from emotion. All right. And the other thing is that there are different levels of emotion. And another colleague of mine in the Boston area, Leonid Perlovsky, fellow neural network modeler who has a physics background, thinks in terms of higher and lower emotions. He and I wrote a joint article in Zygon, which is a religion and science journal, about our knowledge instinct, our drive to comprehend, which Paul Lawrence, who's a late management theorist from Harvard Business School, also talked about a comprehension drive. And satisfaction of the knowledge instinct is related to aesthetic emotions and appreciation of art. Dissatisfaction of it is related to cognitive dissonance and the values of the sublime. And in a paper for last year's neural network conference, I developed a network theory for how these kinds of emotions might be similar, you know, the emotion from listening to great music or beautiful scene in the mountains could be somewhat different from the primary emotions from having your drives for food or sex satisfied or not satisfied, or even relations with somebody going well or badly. There's similarity and there's differences. Some of the brain areas that are engaged are the same for both, and some are different. Different parts, in fact, of the frontal lobes, my theory. All right, now, the idea of reason and emotion as being separate and reason as being somewhat superior dies hard in science. There's a guy named Seymour Epstein, who's a psychologist at University of Massachusetts, who developed a theory that we have two separate mental systems, one intuitive, experiential, and fast, the other rational, deliberate, and slow. So it's really a very either-or stark difference. And Daniel Kahneman's book, Daniel Kahneman is, along with Amos Tversky, revolutionized the field of decision-making. So we wouldn't be where we are without those two. Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2003. Tversky, I think, only didn't share it because he was dead by then. But I think in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which is a very good book, I think he buys into this two systems mentality a little more than I'm happy. Now, why am I not happy with it? Well, intuition is not always fast. It may come after long involvement and much thinking. There's an educated intuition that can't be rationally defined that creative people, whether scientists or poets, have. And I was telling Rob at the dinner table about my choice of graduate school the first time I went through, and I was still before the Vietnam period when I was still doing pure math. And I had comparable offers from several schools. I finally, after a couple of months of deliberation, narrowed it down to Columbia and University of Chicago. On the grounds of what I was interested in, Columbia would have been somewhat better. But I had spent my early years in the area around University of Chicago, and I had a kind of homing instinct to get back there when I had the opportunity. And I remember my mother saying, "You're going to weigh the pros and cons." I just simply said, "I'm not weighing the pros and cons. I just have this push." But this happened only after a couple of months. This was not pre-planned. And this helped. This probably was one of the factors in getting me interested in human decision making. Knowing that the factors involved in human decision making are not necessarily what we plan them to be or what we consciously think they're going to be. So intuition isn't always just a snap judgment. It can sometimes come after a lot of deliberation. And reason is not always slow. My laboratory has collaborated with Dan Krawczyk, who's also an experimental psychologist who has a joint appointment at UT Dallas and UT Southwest, and that does magnetic resonance imaging. And we looked at different people on a numerical judgment task. It's something called the racial bias paradigm in decision making. Which of two probabilities, and it couldn't be described in terms of events or it can be described abstractly, is higher? People unconsciously believe a lot that 10 out of 100 is higher than 1 out of 10, for example. Even though probabilistically they're the same. So they'll even prefer odds of 9 out of 100 to 1 out of 10. Because there's more opportunity. So we studied people who scored high on a test of impulsiveness as one group, and people who were scientific professionals, such as neuroscience grad students at UT Southwest, on the other. And we were expecting to see more activation in the calculation-oriented people in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is the part of frontal lobes which has the most to do with accurate representation of information and going through short-term memory. But we didn't. We didn't see a whole lot of activation there. And we concluded that these folks are so unlike the impulsive people who may weigh the heuristic versus the calculation of the ratio. And the impulsive people eventually, most of the time, got them right, but it took longer. That the calculation people are just so automatic, and you know, here are numbers and I'll do it. So it's reasoning, but it's not slow and it's fairly automatic. All right, now. I've been talking about science. I'm now going to shift gears. I hope to write a book about this eventually. I'm now going to shift gears from what are the scientific facts that are backed up by a combination of experimental neuroscience, experimental psychology, and neural network modeling. Now I'm going to talk about the social implications of it. Why should we care about emotion and reason in that way? Okay, well, I deeply believe it is, it may be an interesting academic exercise, but it is more than an academic exercise. I claim that emotion-reason split is at the heart of many of our cultural crises. And there's a couple of books that kind of hint in that direction, too. There's one by John Saul. I'm not sure if this is the same John Saul who's a novelist, but I think it might be. Called Voltaire's Bastards. And it's subtitled The Dictatorship of Reason in the West. And he goes through a lot of different aspects of culture. And the fact that we have put reason on a pedestal as we've developed more science and technology. But this has led to, you know, splitting of families and relationships. But also, the other interesting thing that Saul said is that while we have elevated reason on a pedestal, we have not really increased the rationality or the scientific literacy of average people. We have created more of a cult of the expert, so the average people more or less trust or maybe even have a love-hate relationship with experts in the sciences. I know that, you know, being called a brainiac is not necessarily treated favorably in all parts of the culture.
It is not rude. It is not rude.
Yes. I realize that, but not everywhere. Now, Michael Lerner is a rabbi, and he's also the editor of an alternative Jewish magazine called Tikkun. Tikkun is a Hebrew word meaning basically here healing, spiritual healing. And I published a couple of book reviews and expository articles in there. And he's also one of the founders of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. Now, Lerner says that we really do have a crisis of meaning in this country. And the fundamentalists and the religious conservatives have exploited it. But they've identified something that's real, and that religious and political liberals, like he is, have been slow to catch on to it. That the crisis of meaning is that people are valued, only tend to be valued much more for their economic value, what they can contribute, even dating relationships are, do you meet my needs? And I see even in the universities, I see people talking increasingly about the importance of training, particularly in the sciences and engineering, to make us competitive in the global market. Not to make us better citizens, not to make us better human beings, but to make us competitive. And that I see as a symptom of it. The symptoms are found everywhere, in education, in medicine, in politics, in finance, in psychotherapy, you name it. So there's this tyranny of the so-called rational marketplace over emotional personal ties. And this is manifested in part two by economic theories that posit us as pure self-interest profit maximizers and cost minimizers.
when in fact our decisions are not made that way, but the belief of a number of people in power that they are made that way, helps, as we discussed at dinner, to reinforce some of the more unpleasant things that are going on, such as the disparities in income and the excessive control by Wall Street and the bankers. And people feel that they are valued only for their ability to produce for a job. And you might think that personal relationships would be a refuge from that, and they can be. But as Lerner documented in his book, even romantic relationships are often based on, can you meet my needs? And people are afraid that their partner will find someone else who meets their needs better down the line. And the idea of ongoing personal things, keeping relationships going because they're there, even for sentimental value, has a certain counter to that which is valuable. I know I found keeping married and keeping my friendships to be emotionally very important for me. So this is part of the crisis, and I see the belief in reason as superior to emotion as a contributing factor to all this. Now, people who feel meaningless, people who don't feel that their lives have meaning, are vulnerable. Like Lerner talks about the manipulation by religious leaders. Also, demagogues, political leaders, people like Hitler, terrorist leaders also, they manipulate people who don't feel emotionally cared for in the society, who don't feel that their lives are meaningful even if they don't achieve something. So, indirectly, the valuing of reason over emotion and the split between them contributes to toxic kind of leadership. Okay, and finally, putting reason over emotion supports other rank orders. Another author who I've been associated with, who I've published with, in fact, Rian Eisler, a feminist historian who wrote several books, of which The Chalice and the Blade is the best known, goes through history and talks about the rank order, and she particularly notes the rank ordering of men over women as being supportive of other kinds of rank orderings. You have haves and have-nots. You have superior, inferior people. And when you say that reason is superior to emotion, it's very easy to say, these other people, they, women, blacks, gays, have all been particularly hit by it, are more emotional, less rational. We need to control them. So that's another pernicious effect. But I don't think that denigrating reason is the answer either. Because we need reason, we need to be able to solve complex problems, we need to be able to come up with solutions that are not exactly what pop into our head. I mean, we should listen to what pops into our head, but not necessarily follow it all the time. So creating a more egalitarian, harmonious society requires making the best of our complex brain pathways that interconnect emotion and reason. And you know, I found it really comforting when I worked with Wally Nauda, who I mentioned earlier, and found that the frontal lobes, which are the furthest developed, they're the last part of our brain to really develop, the last part of our superstructure, our brainiac cortex to develop is the frontal lobes, but But they're also the part, particularly the ventromedial part, which has the strongest connection with the emotional systems. And, you know, some people even say, well, there's an emotional and a cognitive part of the frontal lobes. That's true only up to a point, but really these areas are so densely interconnected that, as Pessoa said, it's very misleading and harmful and destructive to talk about them as separate. So, the brain is really democratic. I'm supposed to be an objective scientist, I suppose, but I have been looking over a lot of my scientific career for evidence to support a certain kind of liberal bias that I have. And I found it. I found it more in the past few years than before. So, the brain is really democratic. People talk about the frontal lobes as the executive, but it's not a king or monarch or dictator. And there are different subparts of the frontal lobe that have different functions that are interconnected. And as a matter of fact, there's one article, I believe is on my website, in which I talk about a book chapter in which I find an analogy between three different parts of prefrontal cortex and the executive, legislative, and judicial parts of our government. There's one area that's the ventromedial orbital part that DiMaggio talks about. That's the legislative part. It has the pulse of the people. It's the one that's more closely tied to the reptilian and old mammalian parts. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is the one that is the most intellectually sophisticated. It can sort of develop new programs the way the executive branch of our government can. And the anterior cingulate, which is kind of a borderline area between the frontal lobes and the limbic system, so it's been considered part of the old mammalian brain. It's kind of on the boundary between the old and new mammalian brain. I think of that as judicial, because it's called into play when there's conflict of one sort or another. And it activates some of the other areas, particularly the dorsolateral, when there's conflict. So all these different parts do different things. There's no one area of the brain that's kind of in control and the final commander of all of them. I mean, there is, as far as motor actions, the basal ganglia seem to be major part, but they've got so many different influences on them that it's hard to call them dictators either. Let me go back and show where some of that area is. Yeah, I mean, you can see the brain from so many different areas. Here's the basal ganglia, here's the amygdala and other parts of the limbic system, and here's the outer layer and the frontal lobes being here, and other areas of it, you know, the cortex. You've got the visual part back here, you've got the motor part up around here, you've got auditory part somewhere around here, and then the rest of it's association and high-level concept. So, brain is really the most complex organism, the most complex piece of machinery any of us know about. And when people say, oh, you're such an expert, blah, 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 I keep reminding them that the difference between an expert and a novice is far smaller than the difference between an expert and what needs to be known. But I really think we're starting to get some connection between the brain and decision-making, and between decision-making and possible social policy. There's another book by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein about how to use decision-making in social policy. Thaler is an economist at the University of Chicago, and Sunstein is a law professor who's moved recently from Chicago to Harvard, and who did something in the Obama administration. So all these areas are coming together. It's a really exciting time. Getting the message out and getting society as a whole to act on these things is a whole other challenge. I'm not sure the best way to do it. Thanks very much.
Okay, so let's open it up for questions. Just real quickly, just try and keep your comments to a minimum and get your question as soon as you're able.
Very fond of Michael Lerner and his book that you mentioned, but I suspect he would be as surprised as I am to suggest that the fundamentalist Christians are somehow aligned with rationality.
No, I'm not saying that the fundamentalist Christian, well, some of the, okay, when you say the fundamentalist Christians, do you mean the leaders or the followers? The leaders may be aligned with rationality because they're exploiting the vulnerability of their followers. They're being rational in a way that, hesitate to say sociopathic, but going in that direction. I'm still not finished. The followers are not rational. The followers have this need that's being expressed. But the leaders are rational in the way they exploit it. They're rational in the same way that a banker or a conniving politician is rational. Yes?
They're selling a product.
Selling a product, exactly.
That's what they're doing.
Right.
They're selling a product.
Yes.
And they profit by it.
Yes.
Pretty simple.
What's your opinion on whether AI, artificial intelligence / machine intelligence, will ultimately be able to handle emotions?
In principle, yes. In principle, if we can understand any process, then we can build a machine to simulate it. Whether it would cost a lot to build that machine, whether it would cost enough to be worth it, that's another issue. But in principle, if we understand something, we understand it at the level of these mechanisms, these connections help to produce it. Now, whether something you build together actually feels the emotion, I mean, that is something people are already somewhat wrestling with. Emotional, quote-unquote, emotional robots are starting to be developed. Whether they actually feel anything, something, you know, whether you have consciousness, that's a whole other can of worms that I don't really know how to answer. That may be something more for philosophers. But in principle, if you have a function and you can, in principle, I think all the functions are understandable and therefore can be duplicated. I would caution, though, that as we understand the functions, we're going to some extent, change the classifications, because the classifications in the language, different types of emotions, or different types of any kind of mental things, are rather imprecise. I don't think we're going to do, well, there's a school of philosophy called eliminative materialism, which says that as neuroscience progresses, folk psychology will simply be abolished. I don't think that is true, but I do think that folk psychology and the classification and art are going to be modified somehow. So, does that answer the question?
You don't really know, but that's true.
But in principle, you can get machines that
you
know this thing.
Okay, let's reverse the assumption and look at Richard Dawkins. Now, you can say the same thing about him as you do about fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
But Richard Dawkins is probably on the opposite side.
Yeah.
Now, would you say
he's got a thing to sell, and he's trying to, he's got a plan, and he's trying to do it the same way.
Well, Dawkins, I don't know, I read some of Dawkins, and I like some of what he says, but I think he goes a bit too far. He goes a bit too far to denigrate spiritual things. I think he's probably relatively sincere, but I don't quite agree with him because he treats us all, well, first of all, his view of evolution, I think it's the traditional Darwinian view, which I think is a bit narrow. I'm part of something called the Darwin Project, which got started by David Lloyd, who's the husband of Leon Eisel, I mentioned earlier. And they have a website, www.thedarwinproject.com. And basically what they're about, they're a bunch of natural and social scientists, about 60, who note that Darwin is mainly identified in the public, and Dawkins is part of this, with survival of the fittest and random mutation and no lack of purpose to change in biological organisms. And Darwin, in some particularly his later writings, really got a great deal into cooperation. And he also got into sexual selection and group selection, as well as natural selection. And he didn't coin the term survival of the fittest, although Herbert Spencer coined it in his lifetime, but Darwin actually said in Descent of Man that survival of the fittest could not account for altruism or self-sacrifice. So I think Dawkins has an overly narrow view of what is scientific and what is, you know, he sweeps away the error of traditional religion, but I think he goes a bit too far with that.
Yes. You made a distinction between short-term emotional responses and long-term emotional responses.
Right.
And I think that's very important. And I guess the short-term emotional responses are the ones that have a bad name. When people get surges of hormones that affect the functioning of the brain, and you know, you can measure cortisol and you can measure testosterone if someone's overcome with lust and things like that. Those are not really helpful, as far as I can see, but it's the long-term emotions that are. And I think, in general, the public identifies emotions with short-term responses.
Yes. Now, short-term emotions are not all bad, I don't
think. Oh, yeah. Some of them are.
I think you're right, and I'm trying to, you know, I do think, though, that that's unfortunate about the language, and that it kind of creates a dichotomy that isn't really there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just want to say, though, the short-term emotional reactions need to be kept in control, but they also can be motivating and create enthusiasm. So I don't think they're all bad.
Doesn't DiMarcio call them affects, which are sort of a pale reflection, a diluted reflection of emotion, rather than emotions?
I don't remember what word he used. Certainly DiMarcio did talk about how emotions can blind us to what's going on, but at the same time, emotions are necessary to power our decisions, to make us decide if one alternative is better than
Dr. Levine, you've left out, and Brian kind of mentioned hormones as kind of a mediator, you know, between these emotions and rationalization. The brain, I gave a talk recently about
the neurochemical, neurological basis for human behavior. And the brain is an endocrine organ, and it puts out, you know, from the hypothalamus, hormones which affect the way we think, and vice versa. When we think, you know, emotional things, it can affect our hormones.
Right.
So I'd like you to say something about that mediation. You know, I agree with you that, I think you probably said this in many words, that evolution, biology, nature doesn't waste things, you know, that we use, we add things on layers.
Yeah.
We don't discard the old brain, you know, that it's all useful, that it all serves a function, biologic, evolutionary function.
All right. I don't know as much about the hormones, but I do know that, remember I mentioned this, let's see, I'm going to go back to, wait a second, I want to go back to one thing I mentioned earlier. Yeah, Wally Nauta, my neuroanatomy teacher, talked about being censored by visceral reactions. Well, the visceral reactions and the hormones, also things like heart rate, blood pressure, skin conductance. But then, the extensive endocrine connections between the hypothalamus and the pituitary, as well as the connections between the hypothalamus and the autonomic nervous system. That's what this is all about. The frontal lobes, you know, kind of, what he's saying is that they, because of these connections, because of the frontal lobes having these connections down to the hypothalamus as well as the limbic system, that the plans that we think about have to get this kind of visceral stamp of approval as well as the stamp of approval in our association cortex. So that's, this is very much hormone brain as well as brain, heart, and other digestive system and so on connections.
Yes, my question is, there seems to be a need in human beings to search for meaning, whether that is arise from emotional or rational. In this talk you have, you don't really distinguish. It seems to me you keep kind of putting that search for meaning is an emotional derived search. To me, that seems to be, might not be always the case. There's always, so the question I have is, why is there a need to search for meaning? Is that a rational need, or is that an emotional need?
That is something I'm very much, very much interested in finding the answer. I'm just scratching the surface of understanding that. And what it is in our brain connections that make us want to have meaning. The review that I did in Qigong was of a book by Daniel Dennett, his book, Breaking the Spell. And he was talking about religion as a natural phenomenon. And my review said that he was kind of getting close to the question you're asking, but not quite asking it. And, you know, he gave examples from his own life that despite being anti-religious and Assange atheist, that he very, very much had this sense of meaning himself. He made it very clear. So I think that I thought that Dennett was just too much tied to this old neo-Darwinian, you know, the kind of thing we're talking about with Dawkins, this neo-Darwinian evolutionary language. And he couldn't get past this survival and reproductive value to maybe we do some things which don't necessarily have survival and reproductive value, but they have value in terms of enhancing the quality of our life, however that's defined. So it's a mixture. To me, it's a mixture of emotional and rational. I talked about Kurlowski's idea and Lawrence's idea of the knowledge instinct or the comprehension drive. That's closely related to it. I mean, it's not entirely the same thing. because meaning calls me, I'm doing things for a purpose and I make the difference and I have connections with people. So, but the comprehension drive is closely connected with it. So it's a very, very difficult problem as to why we have this in the brain. And I'm just scratching the surface of understanding it right now.
Yeah, I have a similar related question I see it as. I'm wondering how disparate you see, or how similar you see rationality and emotion. And can you relate that to the limbic system?
How disparate I see? Well, I see them as parts of a system that are performing somewhat different functions. I mean, like, how similar is your arm to your leg?
I think it's very similar. Arm is just front leg.
yeah. Or your arm to your head for that.
Well, maybe it's different. Yeah. But I'm wondering, is there really that much difference between the functionality of emotion and the functionality of rationality?
Well, the functionality of emotion is you feel certain ways about something, you derive pleasure from some event or pain from some event, and rationality is you see certain events as linked, you see causes, you see consequences of things. So they're very closely linked, but they're different sub-functions of a large system.
Can you relate that to the limbic system? What kind of emotionality or rationality?
The limbic system is part of it, the cortex is part of it, the hypothalamus, which you mentioned, is part of it.
When I see a lizard running across the floor, is he emoting?
Is what?
Is he emoting?
Is who emoting?
The lizard.
Oh. Not sure.
Not sure.
No.
On the closing, you talked about you weren't sure how we should sell this.
Yeah.
How we should put
right.
You can certainly cast subsidy with this book, Nudge, that the government should nudge us away from the bad things that we might do with the cigarettes on the top shelf so it's harder to get.
Yeah.
Nudge us.
Right.
And you mentioned the, I believe your ideal is an egalitarian society. So
right.
Could you talk a little bit about your politics in terms of where you would like all this to get to?
My politics in terms of where I would like all this to get to. Well, I'd like it to get to a place where everybody's included and everybody feels connected to the system. There's nobody is very poor or out of contact or can't do things for a long period of time, and people feel that people find their work is meaningful. Certain degree of, at least, you know, maybe not the government taking care of everything, but a certain degree of economic security combined with meaningful work. Now, from this I've developed an interest in utopias. In fact, one of the articles on my website is an article in the journal Utopian Studies. And it talks about a vision for the future of society that was from another one of my mentors, a national institute, John Calhoun, who was a population ecologist, and something he called the compassionate revolution. And then I talked about what might be parts of this, and then I came up, I found three modern 20th century utopias that seemed to embody a good deal of this. They were Island by Aldous Huxley, Ecotopia by Ernest Kallenbach, and Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy. And then I talked about what some of the things these ideas had, in, these societies had in common? They had greater degree of emotional openness. And this included, you know, they don't have the strict separation between job and personal life. So people were free to say what they felt about things on a job without fear of losing their job or other reprisals. And things were out in the open in terms of family conflicts, and they got resolved. Families were more extended. You know, people may have had strong biological families, but they also had more extended families. It could either be other relatives or neighbors or people interested in the same pursuit. Then one of the final things I had in there, which is one of the more trickier things, is what I called democracy of creativity. And what I meant by that is, as opposed to a kind of, well, you know, like the Greeks had it or the antebellum South had it, a creative class that could pursue the arts and a slave class. That instead of that, okay, we do have a few people who are recognized as premier artists and scientists. So it's not all homogeneity or mediocrity. But at the same time, these artists and scientists still participate in the menial work of the society. And on the other hand, people who have jobs, you know, wire service clerks, short order cooks, janitors, and so on, were encouraged to not just take orders, not just do their job, but be creative, try to do their job as best as possible, you know, speak up if they felt they needed something would help them do their job as well as possible. So, you know, that's kind of a vision both in the political end and in the end of society as a whole. So, is there something I've left out there?
No, I had one question and then we have one more. The Human Genome Project was completed a few years ago, but it's still ongoing in other aspects. And others talk about mapping of the human brain.
Right.
And I was curious about how has data from the Human Genome Project made your job easier or more difficult, or how has it impacted you?
It hasn't impacted me particularly. I have been interested in watching it and watching some of the things people say about the Human Genome Project. And some of the people organizing it seem to be very careful to say genes aren't everywhere. As a matter of fact, I've been talking about throwing the emotion versus reason controversy out the window. The other controversy I want to throw out the window is genes versus environment. There are more and more books coming out, both by scientists and by journalists. Matt Ridley is one of the best journalists on this, that are saying that genetics needs the, our genes need the environment to express themselves, basically. It's certainly true in the brain that it was the prevailing thought among neuroscientists until about the 60s. That the brain is pretty much there at birth. But then there are these discoveries that came about that, for example, in the visual system, that if you didn't get the right kind of visual inputs as a kid or a young organism, you would be blind to certain things later on. So that showed that the genes give us potential, but the environment needs to be there to express it. So all the, and, you know, I see this as, the Nudge book, I see this as strongly related in an odd way. The Nudge says that people's decisions are not constant. People's decisions will in part on what, depend in large part on what incentives are provided to them. And similarly, how genes are expressed. Genes are potentials, and people do differ in their potentials to some extent. But how they're expressed depends on what environment is provided for.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more question.
Something you said.
Well, one person who hasn't.
Who has not asked a question? Anyone that wants to ask a question has not asked a question? Okay.
Something you brought, you said a while ago, Mark, brought up another question for me. When you talked to Quinn here, and then you said that emotion had to do with feelings. It gets you feelings, which is kind of a circular definition there of feelings and emotions. But when a person uses his rational powers and has a research breakthrough, a rational thing that says, aha, I've discovered something, or finish that mathematical equation, wow, doesn't that give him an emotional feeling?
Sure.
A zing?
Sure.
And isn't that an incentive then also to to rational?
Absolutely. I talked about the knowledge instinct and the comprehension drive. That's part of it. It really illustrates you can't separate these stuff.
Okay, let's get going. Thank you. Do you have just a real quick question? You have your hand up.
I said,
real quick.
You mentioned that the dichotomy between the evangelical fundamentalist and you implied that they were all dishonest. Now, do you really believe that?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't certainly. Certainly there's an evangelical movement which is quite sincere, but there is also a subgroup of people who are exploited.
Okay, once again, let's give it to you. If you haven't paid your meal or your drink, make sure you pay your wait staff, and Jack here will collect any monies if you haven't already paid. In 2 weeks, Tuesday, April 23rd, Dr. John Mears with SMU will be speaking on big history, sticking meaning through the perspectives of big history. So,
all right. Thank you. Good deal.